Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
So I've thoroughly enjoyed kind of going through the story of God, of course, just in part just because I like to listen to Morgan Freeman's voice. But I don't want to mislead you if you go watch the series. He's not giving you the Christian perspective. He's not coming from the point of a Christian explaining all these things from Christian perspective. He's sort of taking the typical National Geographic, all-inclusive, Unitarian kind of view of there's a little bit of truth in everybody. And to an extent, I agree with that. There is truth in just about every world religion out there. The problem is while they are all superficially in agreement, they fundamentally have different ends or different foundations. And so he kind of just sort of scratches the surface and said, look, truth, 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 truth. Which should we choose? You choose. And I just want to challenge that to some extent and say, if you go deeper in each of the truths that you find, you'll find that some withstand it and some don't. It's sort of like when your kids come home and they tell you this story of what happened and how this went about and what really happened, why they got this teacher referral, there's a story there, and I'm sure there's some truth. I'm sure Mikey did hit him. But there may be some other truths that are missing there that when you get down to the foundational core aren't really adding up. And so my hope in this series is to sort of go through and give you some of the foundational cores that allow the story to really add up. And then secondly, I kind of was interested in the series just simply because if these are questions that are popular enough for a series to get renewed for a third season, for Morgan Freeman to narrate it, and for maybe people that you know go out and watch it, I want you to have a reason for the hope that you have. I want you to have a way to be able to engage somebody other than just say, well, the Bible says it, I go to church, and really be able to intellectually debate and move through it, because a lot of people believe that there's sort of like the philosophical viewpoints out there, and then there's just dumb Christians who say it's all about faith. And I beg to differ. When you stand on the rock of truth, you really have the best opportunity to argue from a philosophical ground, because at the end of the day, everything's going to lead back to the foundational bedrock of truth, which is kind of where we begin. And in the series, Morgan Freeman, to answer this question of why does evil exist, he wants to go and try to figure out a little bit about evil. And so he goes to one of the places a lot of people think of when they think about the evil in humanity, And he goes to a maximum penitentiary, federal penitentiary, and talks with a guy who is a sociopath and a serial killer, and asks him questions about, why are you like this? Where did this come from? Why, you know, are you evil? And it reminds me, maybe if you hadn't seen the series, maybe you've seen another interview that happened with a sociopath who was a serial killer. It was done by Agent Sterling, and she goes and talks with a very well-known sociopath named, anybody? Hannibal Lecter. And she asks him, what happened that made you like this? And he looks back on her, and of course, this is a sort of a thinking person sort of horror movie. It's called a psychological thriller, if you will. And so he kind of goes a little deep with her, and he says, nothing happened to me, Officer Sterling. I wish I had his voice, you know, just the that sort of, you know, creepy, mystic voice. He says, nothing happened to me. I happened. You can't reduce me to a set of influences. You've given up good and evil for behaviorism, Officer Sterling. You've got everybody in their moral dignity pants, and nothing is ever anybody's fault. Look at me, Officer Sterling. Can you stand and say that I am evil? I am evil, Officer Sterling. So he poses that question, can you say that I am evil? Now, what's behind all this is modern philosophical approach is we don't like the word evil because that implies religion, and so we want to try to find some sort of naturalistic explanation for why people do the things that we do. And so we want to know, what's their environment like? What was their childhood like? Maybe we can explain why they are the way they are if you look back and see what happened to them. And in the midst of this, there was an author who comes from that worldview, and he came to the problem of evil, and he couldn't find a good explanation outside of God for evil. And so in the opening of his book, the name of the book is Andrew Del Bonco's book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. So he comes at this from the secular worldview, much like Agent Sterling had, and he says, A gulf has opened up in our culture between the visibility of evil and the intellectual resources available to cope with it. We've jettisoned the idea in the West of the idea of a cosmic evil or a transcendent evil or a supernatural evil. We don't even believe in any of those things. In fact, we don't even like to use the word evil. The reason we don't like it is because it implies there's value judgments or moral absolutes. So instead, we move towards medical terms like a dysfunction or a pathology or a sociological factor. We don't like to use the moral terminology, but the 20th century has gone on and it has gotten harder and harder to look at things like serial killers, the Holocaust, and terrorism and determine that they are just the products of a bad sociological or a psychological adjustment. So as you begin to look at those things and you watch the Holocaust, and it's hard to look at that and say, you know, I think Hitler was just a product of his environment, probably had some bad social influence. I wouldn't say it was evil. It just, I think he was just a little mentally unstable. It's hard to say that. You know, the idea that there is no moral absolute leads you to say that everything is a matter of opinion. And what's right for you may not be right for me. And what's wrong for you may not be wrong for me. And so while you and I might agree that the Holocaust was evil, the Nazis thought it was good. And so everybody's entitled to their opinion. You hear that and you're like, I don't know if I quite agree with that anymore. Because I don't think the Holocaust being evil is really a matter of opinion. And this was also the very same thing that Dr. King had an issue with when he was in prison in Birmingham. And he writes a letter. Maybe many of you have heard about a letter from a Birmingham jail. Now, a lot of people don't know the context of the letter. I know the context simply because it's kind of near and dear to me, because he's writing to a group of pastors. I thought that was kind of interesting. What's he have to say? What was the issue going on? The issue was a group of pastors in the area had gotten together and were sort of teaming up and condemning Dr. King for breaking the law, basically saying, how can you as a pastor break the law? You need to work within the laws to sort of bring about sociological change, because you can't go out there as a lawbreaker and say that you're a pastor. That doesn't really add up very well. And so Dr. King, with great dignity and class and intelligence, writes back what's now become a very famous letter. And in the letter, he says this. He says, one might well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. And I would be the first to advocate that obey just laws. One not only has a legal but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. In other words, if the government passes a law that says you can't feed the homeless, you have a moral obligation to disregard that law. As a matter of fact, there was a Christian group in the city of Philadelphia where they had passed a law that says you can't feed the homeless. So the idea was they want to drive the homeless out of the city, and the problem with all the homeless in the city was all these Christian groups kept on feeding them. So they passed a law, you can't feed the homeless. And the Christian group said, that is an unjust, immoral law. We're going to go feed them anyway. And so sure enough, they went and did it in defiance of the law. They all got arrested. And when the judge presided over the case, he looked at it and he said, you know, our forefathers looked at laws that were imposed on us by Britain and did not feel they were just, and that's why we have the founding of this nation. This is an unjust law. I'm throwing it out. And so that's exactly what Dr. King is arguing for here. And he says, I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. So what is the difference between the two, he writes? How do we determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is any law that is out of harmony with the moral law. Hence, segregation is not only politically and economically and sociologically unsound, it is morally wrong and sinful. Now, if you don't hold to the view that there is an inherent evil, if you don't hold to the view that there is a moral absolute, a moral right, and a moral wrong, then you have to say that right and wrong is really a matter of opinion, and therefore it's a majority vote. And if the majority says it's wrong, then it's wrong. The majority says it's right, then it's right. But we look at the certain things, we look back on history and say, even though the majority said that was right and okay, it wasn't okay. And there's something within me that says, I don't think that's a matter of opinion. I inherently think it's just wrong to do that. I look at the Holocaust and I say, that's not a matter of opinion. It's just wrong. I'm not looking for it was a product of his environment, you know, it was just the times. No, it was wrong then, and it's wrong now, and it will ever be wrong because it's just flat out wrong. Well, who gives you the right to say that? I'm going to pause that. I'm going to go to a different line of thinking. There's another issue that comes up with the problem of evil. These are both going to converge back on. Another issue that comes up with the problem of evil, and that is, if God is loving, let's just assume that there is a God. If God is loving and he's all-powerful, why is it that evil then would exist? Because it would make sense that if God was loving, he wouldn't allow for evil, and if he had the power to stop it, he would. This argument was first posed back in ancient Greek by a guy named Epicurus. And he posed sort of an A plus B equals C proposition. He says, if there is a God who's all-powerful and all-loving, then there would be no suffering. However, there is suffering, so therefore, there is no God. And that was his line of thinking. And this line of thinking has been picked up again and again over the centuries. And actually, as a matter of fact, it finally sort of died out as a philosophical argument for atheism in the early 80s. And since then, nobody's really touched it. And you might say, well, why? Is it because it finally got played out and we've disproven God? No, quite the opposite. It's one of those things that kind of came back to bite the atheists in the butt, really. I don't know how else to say that, but it's just, it really has. For, let's go to, what is a definition of evil? How do you define evil? At some point, your definition of evil, if you, you know, you can't just say that it's a majority opinion. At some point, people come back and they say, well, I know it when I see it. Or wrong is just flat out wrong. And you begin to realize that to say something is evil or to say something is wrong implies that there is something that is inherently right. And how do you go from the universe is all a result of a chaotic, accidental, cosmic happening, and then come and say there is a rightness or a wrongness to how everything should be? You can't make that jump there. And so if you're going to say that there is a right and there is a wrong, that is implying then that there is some standard out there that has set a right or a wrong, and what would that standard be? And you see where this thing comes back around and kind of hits you from behind, and you realize you just walked in the back door and found God. And that's exactly what happened to C.S. Lewis. He was struggling with this. He was an atheist philosopher before he ever wrote the Chronicles of Narnia and such. And he goes through and he says, my argument with God is that the universe just seemed way too cruel and unjust for there to be a loving and powerful God. But how had I gotten even the idea of something as just or unjust? What was I comparing this universe to when I called that it was unjust? Of course, I'd given up any sense of justice by saying it was just my own private idea. But when I did that, my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on me saying that the world really was unjust, not just simply that I believed it was unjust. And he says, consequently, my atheism turned out to be far too simple. You see, you want to go down the simple idea and just say, oh, well, you know, if there was a loving God, all this stuff wouldn't be happening. But once you probe it a little bit deeper, you begin to realize that the very nature of the fact that you say something is unjust or wrong is implying that there is a rightness and a justice. And how do you get a universal rightness or justice? You go deeper and you find that it's God. See, atheism, he says, was just too shallow of a thought. And what you find as Morgan Freeman goes around and he talks with these different philosophers and idealists from anywhere ancient Egypt to the Eastern religions, etc., is you'll find sort of a very shallow idea of what it is. Let's just not go dig any deeper. And so as C.S. Lewis digs deeper, he ends up finding God once again in the midst of it. And so at the end of the day, evil is not just an opinion. It is that which is defined by something that is unjust. It is that which is immoral, that which is unrighteous or wrong. And dare we even say it is ungodly. And so the very presence of evil, rather than sort of defying the notion of God, actually defines and proves the existence thereof. Because as soon as you say something is evil, you've just declared there is a moral lawgiver and there is a universal justice. And you're pointing back to, then there must be a God. Now, you might then ask, well, why would God allow for evil? Why would he, I don't want to say create evil, because God hasn't created evil. Well, if he hasn't created evil, then why do we have evil? Well, I would say it this way. God didn't create evil, he created the opportunity for evil. Now, that may be splitting hairs, but in theological terms, sometimes you have to get down very specific. I would explain it like this. I grew up in South Florida, and so going to Disney World was sort of probably like about how many of y'all go to Busch Gardens quite a bit. You get annual passes, and we would just go quite a bit. And as you grow up, when you're a little kid, you go on rides like the Jungle Cruise, or back in the day they had Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I think now it's been replaced by Winnie the Pooh or Peter Pan. There's all kinds of scary animals that jump out at you, right? And when you're a kid, they really are terrifying. I mean, you're scared. I mean, an alligator almost jumps up and eats you on the Jungle Cruise. But as you get older, you realize that every time I go on the Jungle Cruise, the same alligator jumps out of the same spot. Every time. It's like you know it's coming. And he doesn't do anything. He misses every time. We just barely escape danger. At some point, you realize it's a robotic gator. It's not real. It's just fake. And then as you get a little bit older, you begin to realize that the guy driving the boat isn't even driving the boat. You know, they start off and he's driving, and then he's holding the wheel and talking, and then pretty soon he's just talking to you, not even holding the wheel, and the boat's navigating it. It's like, wait a minute. How are we getting? And then you look in the water and you see in the murky water there's a track. This whole thing's on a track. And you see, God didn't create the world like the Magic Kingdom. He created a little bit more like Animal Kingdom. Now, Animal Kingdom, I went when Animal Kingdom first opened, and it was a revolutionary experiment for Disney. I remember going on it, and I remember thinking to myself, are these going to be real animals or are these things fake? Because a lot of stuff Disney says is real is fake. Like all those bushes that they have like clipped to shape like animals, the only ones that are real are the ones you can touch. Now, if you see, when you're first going in and you go through the big gate, there's some animals way out in the fields. If you've been to Disney World enough, you'll get in traffic jams. And if you're daring enough, you'll go out and want to take a picture with one of them. They're fake. It's plastic. And so I thought to myself, okay, are these going to be real animals or are these things just going to be really good animatronics? Are they going to be behind a net? How's this going to work out? They actually are real animals. And once I realize they're real animals, you do begin to realize they've kind of made it so that they make it look like as if the vicious animals could get to the truck, but they really can't. So they've at least, you know, worked that out. But one thing I went on the safari ride in Disney, in Animal Kingdom, about 4 or 5 times to figure this out. Then now that there's internet, you can figure it out on the internet. I had to go on it 4 or 5 times because I was sure that the truck was somehow robotically controlled. There's no way this guy's driving. Disney doesn't let anybody drive. Everything's on a track. Everything's remote control. No, actually, the guy's actually driving the truck. I blew my mind. He really is driving that truck. It's not robotically controlled. It's not GPS controlled. It's not on a track. He really is driving the truck. And they've actually had some accidents. Not a lot, but every once in a while, the guy will mess up. Doesn't happen very often, like I said. But it can happen, and it actually has. And so they were taking a chance with that. And that's kind of what God has done with humanity. God did not create evil, but he chose to give you the opportunity for evil. He placed a tree in the middle of the garden and said, don't eat this one. You can do whatever you want. Just don't eat this. And so he provided the opportunity. In the same way that I've been to Disney World now with my kids, and we went on the Goodyear racetrack. And with great confidence and pleasure, I said, here, you want to drive? And so they got to drive. And I didn't really care because at the end of the day, the car was on a track, right? I mean, there's only so much you can do. You know, you can jerk it back and forth. I think the most dangerous thing you can do on that track is hit the car in front of you, which, after all, it's your brother, and so you probably are trying to do that and for fun anyway. But you're not going to, you know, create a big, you know, 6-car pileup. I'm scared to death of the day that I actually hand my real keys to a real car over to any of my kids. Anybody with me on this? I think that's a scarier roller coaster ride than any theme park has invented. You have no steering wheel, you have no brake, you have nothing. Like, I've often thought, you know, you could make a really good living if you could rent out a car that either had a brake or a second steering wheel in it. That's what they do for airplanes, right? Airplanes, you got 2 controls. Don't you think you could make a good living renting out a car that had two steering wheels and 2 brakes? Anybody with me on this? Business idea, start it out, you know, teach driver or something like that. I think that's what I want as a parent before I just say, here you go. Why? Because I know when I do that, I am giving you the opportunity to do a lot of damage. Now, I'm not causing it. I'm not the author of it. I don't even think I should be to blame for it. But I'm definitely giving you the opportunity for it. That's the way God's created humanity. He's given you the opportunity to choose. So God's not the author of evil, but he did create a world in which it's possible. He did create the world in which it's an option. Why? Well, without it, it'd be nothing more than a robotic falsehood that is the magic kingdom. I mean, that's really what life would be. You'd just be a bunch of robots going around on a track, and if you're young enough and dumb enough, you'll think you're really driving that car. But God wanted more. He wanted to give you the opportunity to actually determine where you're going to go. Are you going to follow the path he's laid out before you, or are you going to off-road it and take your chances? And that's really what he puts in your hands. Then you come back and you say, okay, I can understand why then maybe God allowed for evil, but what about the evil I've experienced? I mean, why do I have to suffer because of somebody else's choices? Why? What about evil that's not really anybody's choice? What about natural disasters? I mean, can we agree that's an evil when a tsunami takes out half a continent? Can we not agree that it's an evil or a bad or a at least unfair, if you will, thing for a hurricane or a tornado to hit one house and not another? That's at least unfair. There's some sort of injustice there. What about that kind of thing? And for that kind of question, I got to look at four different people and four different characters in the scriptures. And the first is going to be Job. Job is a book about suffering. And in the story of Job, it kind of starts off something like this. Job and God have a great relationship. I always say that this life is about nothing more than having a loving relationship with God that you'll enjoy for all eternity. And sure enough, that's exactly what Job had. He had a loving relationship with God that he was all set to enjoy for all eternity. And Satan comes in and he's like, you know, so God, how's this whole experiment working out for you? You know, you allowed for the opportunity of evil, and it looks to me like pretty much everybody's gone that path and nobody really wants to have a relationship with you. And he says, have you considered my servant Job? He's like, yeah, I've considered Job, but you know, you've kind of bought him off, haven't you? I mean, he's got the perfect family. He's got the perfect life. He's wealthier than anybody else around him, and he's got it all good. You know, if you bribe anybody, of course they're going to like you. You don't really know that this guy likes you. He just likes you because of all the stuff you gave him. I mean, everybody's into the prosperity gospel, and he's the poster child for it. And God says, no. That's not the nature of my relationship with him. Job loves me no matter what. And no matter what happens, he's going to stand by me through thick and thin. He's in this for the long haul. He loves me for me. And Job says, really? Prove it. And so God says, okay, we'll play this out. Have your way, do what you will, but you're not shaking my man. I mean, he is the GOAT. He's the Michael Jordan of anything. He is, I hate to say it, he is the Tom Brady of relationships here. Okay, I mean, he has it. I hate saying that, by the way, as a Dolphin fan. And God's up in heaven basically bragging in a cosmic way over Job. Now, the thing about it is, Job doesn't know that's what's going on. Job's never told that. You, the reader, are told that, but Job isn't told that. Job's experiencing suffering as it comes. A natural disaster comes in and wipes out his family. People come in and destroy all of his crops. He has a raiding army comes in and steals from him and takes from him and destroys everything he has. He then ends up losing his health, and he ends up having a really rough and bad marriage. And in the midst of all of that, he doesn't walk away from God, but he asks the question we all ask, why? And there's a piece that's frustrating as a reader because God never tells him why. And you're like, as a reader, you're going, but God, it's actually, dare I say, a pretty good why. I mean, honestly, think about this for if you will. Whatever you've gone through in your life, think of your Job experience, your trials, your sufferings, your pains you've gone through. Would it make a difference to you if God comes down and he says, all right, here's the deal, before you go into it, or maybe why you're not, like, listen, I know it's really rough right now, but here's the deal. I've been bragging on you. I've been bragging on you to Satan. And I've been talking trash to him about our relationship because of how awesome you are and the kind of person you are. And he's asked if he can put you through hell on earth to see if you'll walk away from me, but I got confidence in you, and I believe in you, and I know you and you who you are, and you ain't going to do it because you my man. You my girl. And for all time, billions of people will read about what happened and what's going down right now in your life. And we'll enjoy laughing about this someday for all eternity, about how you and me showed up Satan once and for all. You game? How many of y'all say, sign me up? Sign me up. But they never have that conversation. Instead, he's got these conversations with his friends who come and say, well, you know, all this stuff's really happening because you done something, man. We all get what we deserve. And don't start acting like you all holy and perfect because you done something. You must have done something wrong. You just ain't telling nobody. Or maybe if, you know, even if you're perfect, you ain't perfect. And if you just did one thing, doesn't God have a reason to let everything come down on you? I mean, come on now. You break one law, you're a lawbreaker. He's got other friends that come in and say, well, you know, God's just trying to teach you a lesson. When people tell me that, I'm like, listen, sometimes I really feel like the education is not worth the tuition. Right? What could I learn that taking away family members or health is somehow going to make it all worth it? No, that doesn't add up. Nope, nope, sorry. Just, I'd rather live in ignorance than pay that price. And so he goes all through these, and all these things are all frustrating, and they should be, because they're not the right answer. So finally God speaks, and you're waiting, like, okay, God's finally going to tell him. No, God doesn't tell him. He says, Job, can you just trust me? I got some things going on here that I can't explain to you right now. You know, there's a lot of stuff in this world I don't explain to you. I haven't told you exactly why it rains when it rains. I haven't explained to you a lot of the mysteries of the universe, because, number one, you're not going to understand them even if I did. And number two, I'm God and you're not, and I don't have to explain myself. And I've put a lot of stuff in this world to try to teach you this lesson that you can't control everything, you can't control outcomes, that some things are my prerogative. Can you just trust that I know what I'm doing? And I have your best interests in mind? That I've got a good heart, can you just trust me in this? And Job comes back and he says, God, I had spoke of things and questioned things I shouldn't have questioned, and so I know that no plan of yours can be stopped, and I'm in. And true to form, just like God said, he doesn't walk away. And so there's sometimes, yeah, people say everything happens for a reason, but here's the thing, you may not know the reason. This side of heaven, you may not be told the reason. Now, there are some things that have happened in your life, and you look back now, and you're like, gotcha. I get it now. And someday we'll sit down in heaven with God and we'll look back over our life and we'll have that moment where we go, okay, if I had to do it all over again, God, sign me up. I'm good with it. I see what you were doing. I see the plan now. I see how it's all working out. It's like when an ice sculpture, you ever seen an ice sculpture work? You ever seen Bob Ross paint? Bob Ross will make this beautiful painting and then he screws it up. And then you're like, whoa, no, that was awesome. There's a new tree. The tree needed a friend. Whoa, I didn't realize that tree needed a friend until it got a friend. And it makes the painting what it is, right? I live for that experience someday with God. Second verse we learn from about suffering and why we're experiencing, why God allows it is the same kind of lesson that Job is learning, John also learns. John has this moment where he says back to Jesus, are you really the one or am I mistaken here? I mean, I was thinking, I could kind of see what was working. I could kind of see the plan. But I'm kind of starting to realize I'm going to be left out here on the plan. And if things keep going the way they're going, I'm going to get beheaded. And I don't really think that's the way it was supposed to work out. Like, I mean, I was your cousin. We was in. I was going to lead the way. We had this whole thing worked out. And it's not working out like that. So I got to know. Are you really the one or did I get this whole thing wrong? And what we see in both John's relationship and Job's relationship is that our trials really are a test of our relationship. I mean, do you really love me or not? You see, like, if you've ever been to a 50th wedding anniversary, there's one thing you can say about a 50th wedding anniversary, is these two people, they have to love each other to still be here, right? Because there's been a lot of grace and a lot of forgiveness to have gone through to live with another sinner for 50 years, right? But there's other times you go to an actual wedding and you're kind of looking at it going, I don't think this one's going to last. I mean, I hear what they're saying and all, but I don't know. I mean, they're saying for better, for worse, but here's what I can tell you about marriage. It's going to get worse. One of you is going to lose your health, if not both. You're going to be poor. You're going to be broke. All those things, everything you promised, you're going to deal with the worst and then some of everything you promised. And eventually, at death, one of you will depart. That's what you're in for when you get there. And life will test that vow. It will. Life will test your vow that you make to God when you say, God, I love you, and I want an eternal relationship. Your trials will test that. Job, he made it through the test. John, he made it through the test too. And your trials will test the validity and the realness of your relationship, because your emotions can fool you. You can think you're in love, but you're not really in love. You can think you love God, but it's not until you go through hell on earth do you really know, am I sticking with God or am I going to bail on this thing? A lot of people followed Jesus, and then it says in the scripture, and they followed him no more. So it really tests the validity of your relationship. Next thing we learn is a lesson from Jesus, and that is God's not apart from your suffering. He's not separated from it. He is not aloof of it. He is not unaware of it. As a matter of fact, he loves you so much and cares about you so much that he's willing to come down and experience it alongside you and with you in it. You know, he's not like in this ivory tower up here going, okay, just suffer for a little while and it'll all be good with me. Just keep going through it. You can easily come back and say, God, you don't know what I'm going through here right now. You don't have that ability. You see, one who really loves is one who gets down in the midst of it and says, I'm going to get dirty with you. I'm going to suffer with you. I'm going to work through this with you. When you think about the life that Jesus lived, he took on all the evils this world has to throw at him. I mean, he had people who were jealous of him, people who talked behind his back and gossip, people who betrayed him, lied about him. He had a politically motivated murder. He was mocked the whole way as he went to it. He went through every kind of unjust suffering you could possibly imagine on this earth. Why? So you and I would know that God is not immune and unaware of the evil that we go through. He loves you so much, he's willing to join you in it. But then more importantly, he does it so he can take away any consequence of evil in your life. And what is God's answer for evil? To take the blame for it. To take the blame for it for anyone who has a relationship with him. He meets with his disciples on the last night he's with them, and he says, this is a cup of redemption. If you know the verse that he's coming from, it's a cup of redemption, for God has poured out his judgment. Who's the judgment getting poured out upon, Jesus? Me. It's your redemption. It's my judgment. And God's answer for evil is simply, I'm going to take the blame for your evil. When you have a relationship with me, that's what I did at the cross. That's what we celebrate with this meal. Third lesson we learn it both from Jesus and also from a guy named Joseph. And what happens in Joseph's life is, like Jesus, he's betrayed. He's betrayed by his brothers. His brothers were going to kill him, but they said, you know, there's really no money in that. Maybe we could make a buck off of this betrayal. And so they sell him as a slave. So he gets in Egypt. Things actually turn out well for him for a while. Then he gets sold out and betrayed again. He gets put in jail. And things are going as best as they possibly could in jail. And he gets his hopes up, thinking he's going to get out. And then he gets forgotten about again. And he's left there to rot for 14 years. And then he gets out. And he ends up getting in, you know, this great position in politics. He's like the, you know, prime minister of Egypt, the most powerful country in the world at the time. And then his brothers come begging for food. And then there's this scene where his brothers come before him and they're thinking they're going to finally have to pay the piper for what they did all those years ago. And they try to come up with some scheme. They're going to try to swindle their way out of it again. And Joseph just looks at him and says, guys, don't bother. Don't bother, not because the judgment's coming on you, but because I'm not mad at you. What you did was evil, but God used it for his good. Just because things turned out good, don't act like as if what you did wasn't evil. Don't act like what you did wasn't intended for evil. Don't say, hey, you know, if I hadn't, you know, betrayed you, you'd never have this great job. So, hey, cut me in. No, what you did was evil. But I serve a God who works all things for good. And you see, evil, when touched by God, is no longer evil. You see that? What do we call the worst day in human history? The day when evil took the life of the Son of God. What do we call that? We call that the craziest name of all, which, if I dare say, is an understatement as we assess its worth and its value in history. Good Friday? See, what God does with evil is he redeems it. He changes it. He makes it holy somehow. And he can take the evil in each one of us in a relationship with him and use it for his good, use it for his glory, and make you good and allow you to glorify him. Evil is not a problem for God. It's just another thing that serves his purposes. You pray with me. Father, in my life, I have struggled with everything that I have just talked about. This is a message, Father, that comes both as a result of reading Scripture and of crying, of pain. It is a lesson that has been learned in the hardest of ways. And Father, it's a lesson that I continue to forget. Father, that every trial that comes into my life is only there because you have allowed it and sanctioned it. But Father, I sometimes fail to trust that it is all for the good. That someday I'll look back upon it and say, Father, you are so good. Someday I'll apologize for my frustration and anger towards you. Someday I'll realize what it is that you are doing in the midst of my darkest and hardest days. So, Father, right now I just repent. I apologize for my anger towards you, for my blaming you, because you didn't do things the way that I would have wanted them to be done. Father, I just ask, Lord, that you would help me continue to praise you, both for the evils in the past, and to be able to praise you in the present when evil enters my life. Knowing, Father, that everything that is meant for evil, you use for the good. Knowing that in your hand, in your touch, in your presence, even the evil becomes good. So, Father, I look forward to the day in which I can stand with you and triumph in joy as I watch your justice come out over evil. And also stand with you, Father, when you wipe away every tear and remove evil once and for all and the possibility for evil for all eternity. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.